United States Marshal Ben Kyle sat at the desk in his office in Sentinel, drumming his fingers as he looked at the passenger list from the train wreck. By now, all the dead had been identified, as had all the injured. Some of the uninjured passengers had already continued their westbound journey, but he had managed to talk to each of them before they left. None of them recalled seeing a man brought on board in chains, and none recalled seeing anyone in chains leave the scene of the wreck. Sentinel had been the final destination for four of the passengers, and he had spoken to them as well. But none of them could recall seeing a man in chains. Or at least, if anyone saw him, they wouldn't admit to it.
Why is that? Are they all frightened? Has Jensen gotten to them, threatened them in some way?
As Kyle continued to study the passenger list, he picked up his pencil and then drew a line under two names.
Louise Dobbs, Jerry Dobbs.
Marshal Kyle knew Louise and Jeremiah Dobbs. They owned a small ranch just outside of town. Mrs. Dobbs and her two children, Jerry and Susie, had gone to Purgatory to visit her sister and were returning when the train was wrecked. Purgatory was where Matt Jensen had boarded, and Mrs. Dobbs had to have seen him. In fact, as he recalled the incident now, young Jerry had almost said something to him. When questioned, Jerry said that he hadn't seen anything. But that was only after a stern glance from his mother. Kyle had seen the look Louise Dobbs gave her son then, but because her little girl had been killed, he had not wanted to bother her with questions, hoping that he would get the information he needed from one of the other passengers. Unfortunately, that had not worked out for him. And now, it appeared as if Mrs. Dobbs would be his only source.
Boomer?
Yes, sir?
I'm gonna ride out to the Dobbs ranch.
You're going to question Mrs. Dobbs, aren't you?
Yeah, but I swear I'd rather be horsewhipped than bother that poor woman right now.
I don't blame you. Would you like for me to come with you?
No, I appreciate the offer, but there's no need for that. You just hold down the fort while I'm gone.
Yes, sir, I'll do that. Benjamin, why is it, do you suppose, that nobody wants to tell us anything about this Jensen fella? Do you think he has them all buffaloed?
I don't know, Boomer. I've been wondering about that myself. Maybe I can find out something from Mrs. Dobbs.
The Dobbs ranch was about 5 miles south of Sentinel, and when Marshal Kyle rode up to the house, he saw that there were at least half a dozen wagons and buckboards parked out in the yard, the team still in harness and standing quietly. At first, he was surprised that there were so many people here. Then, suddenly, he realized that he must have arrived around the time of the funeral. These were all friends, neighbors, and relatives come to pay their respects to the Dobbses over the loss of their little girl. For a moment, he wished he hadn't come to impose on them, and he was considering turning around when Jeremiah Dobbs stepped out onto the porch to greet him.
Marshal Kyle, how nice of you to come to Susie's funeral. My wife and I never expected anything like this. You honor us. Please, get down and come here.
Yeah. How you doing, Jeremiah?
I'm doing as well as can be expected, I suppose. Having lost my little girl. It's Louise I'm worried about. She's taking this real hard. She keeps blaming herself.
Well, now that's ridiculous. Why would she blame herself?
Well, that's what I keep telling her, but she says if she hadn't gone to see her sister when she did, or if she had taken better care of Susie while they were on the train, maybe Susie would still be with us.
None of that has anything to do with this wreck, or with Susie getting killed. I know she's upset, but as soon as she realizes that there was nothing she could have done to prevent it, I expect she'll come around.
Well, I certainly hope so.
Kyle followed Jeremiah into the house. There were at least two dozen people gathered in the parlor. There were a few people down at the end of the large room who appeared to be looking down at something. And as Kyle studied them more closely, he realized with a start that they were staring at the body of the little girl.
Would you like to see her? Mr. Albritton fixed her up just real nice. She looks just like she's sleeping.
Well, I...
Kyle was about to tell Jeremiah that he would just as soon not look at the little girl, but he knew that the viewing of his daughter's remains was very important to Jeremiah.
Yes, I would be very honored to look at her.
Jeremiah led Kyle through the room toward the open coffin. The coffin was child-sized. The lid was open, and Susie could be seen lying in the coffin, her head slightly elevated by a white pillow. She was wearing a pink dress with white lace, and her hands crossed in front of her grasped a single yellow rose. Her blonde hair cascaded over her shoulders in ringlets of curls. The pallor of death had been pushed back by the artful application of paint and powder.
Doesn't she look just like a little angel?
Yes, she does.
Louise Dobbs was sitting on the far side of the room. Jerry was on the floor beside his mother, and Louise's left hand was resting on Jerry's shoulder. In her right hand was a tightly gripped wadded handkerchief, the handkerchief wet with her tears. Kyle hated to use this time to question her, but he had ridden this far, and here he was, so he might as well get it done. He drew a deep breath, squared his shoulders, and then walked over to see her.
Mrs. Dobbs, may I offer you my most sincere sympathy?
Thank you.
I wonder if I could ask you a few questions.
What about?
About the train wreck.
I don't know anything about it. One minute we were riding along normally, and the next moment the car was bumping all over the place. Then it went off the track and turned over. I don't remember much after that.
Yes, ma'am. Well, that's not exactly what I want to talk about.
What is it, then?
I'm trying to find the man who caused all this. He killed the deputy from Purgatory. Then I'm sure that somehow he caused the wreck so he could steal the money and get away in all the panic and confusion. I think that man's name is Matt Jensen, and he got on the train in Purgatory the same time you did. I'm hoping you might have seen him.
He didn't cause the train wreck, and I don't believe he killed the deputy or stole the money.
Mrs. Dobbs, excuse me, but what do you mean? I'm confused as to why he would say such a thing. Do you know this man?
No.
Then how can you be so sure that he didn't cause the wreck, kill the deputy, and steal the money?
Because he saved my life. And he also saved the lives of several others on the train. If he had done all those things you said he did, I do not believe he would have stayed around to help the others. Do you believe that he would?
I don't know. There's no telling how some people are going to react to certain things. He may have just done that to throw people off.
No, that wouldn't be necessary. In fact, Jerry and I are the only ones who could have recognized him, so he had no reason to throw people off. I knew who he was the moment he showed up in the car where I was pinned under the seat. He had been in chains when he got on the train, but somehow he got out of the chains. And I'll tell you the truth, Marshal, I was very glad to see him because, as I say, he saved my life.
Let's say you are right. Let's say that he did save your life.
There is no let us say to it. He did save my life.
All right. He did save your life. If that is the case, then don't you think that might cause you to have a loyalty to him? A loyalty that is misplaced, especially if he was the cause of the accident in the first place.
How could he have caused the accident? You said yourself that he was in chains.
But by your own admission, he wasn't in chains when you saw him, was he?
No.
Could you describe him for me?
I don't think I can.
You don't think you can, or you don't think you will?
Louise didn't answer.
Mrs. Dobbs, please.
You can say anything you want, Marshal. You are not going to make me believe that this man, Matt Jensen, did all the terrible things you said he did. Like I told you, he worked harder than anyone to pull people out of the wreckage. Then he helped Dr. Presnell tend to the injured. As a matter of fact, I doubt that he was even guilty of whatever crime put him in chains in the first place.
First-degree murder. He was tried and convicted and was on his way to Yuma to be hanged until he got away.
Well, all I can say is, I'm glad he got away.
I see. Again, Mrs. Dobbs, my condolences for your loss.
Kyle turned and walked away. Unwittingly, Louise Dobbs had given him more information than she realized. She had told him that the man he had looked for had worked with Dr. Presnell. All he had to do now was talk to the doc. When Odom and Bates left Quigatoa, Paco and Schuler stayed behind. Schuler stayed because he had gotten drunk the night before and was still passed out drunk the next morning. Paco stayed too, and his words, to look after Schuler.
Señor. Señor, wake up.
What is it? What do you want?
Wake up, señor.
Sitting up, Shula rubbed his eyes, pinching the bridge of his nose, then looked around.
Paco, what are you doing here?
I have come to wake you up, Señor Shula.
Why?
Because you are in the room of my sister. My sister is a puta. She needs the room now.
What time is it?
It's 7 o'clock, I think.
Damn, I need a drink.
Paco handed Shula a bottle of tequila, and Shula turned the bottle up to his lips.
Paco, what are you doing here?
My sister needs this room now.
All right.
There was no need for Shula to get dressed because he was wearing the same clothes he'd had on when he went to bed the night before. For that matter, he was wearing the same clothes he'd worn last week and the week before that. Shula got to his feet rather unsteadily, stabilized himself for a moment by holding onto the bedpost, then, summoning as much dignity as he could, took 2 steps across the little room and opened the door. Shula followed Paco to the head of the stairs, then stopped for a moment in order to steady himself before he tackled a task at going down the narrow, steep flight of stairs. Then, standing on the main floor, he looked around the saloon for the others.
Do you want breakfast, senor?
Oh, breakfast? No. Well, where are Odom and Bates?
Odom said we are to meet him and Bates in Puxico.
We are to meet him in Puxico? Why?
We will divide the money there.
I don't understand. Didn't we divide the money last night?
See, we divided the money last night. But then, we gave the money back to Senor Odom.
We did?
See.
Why do we do that?
Senor Odom said it would be better if we went to Puxico before we divided the money. Do you not remember this, amigo? We talked about it, and we all agreed.
No, I don't remember. I don't think I would agree to such a thing. I don't want to go to Puxico.
That's because you are drunk, senor.
All right. Are you coming?
You go, senor. I will come later.
Puxico?
Si, Puxico.
Paco watched Shula leave the saloon and walked over to the window. He saw Shula saddle his horse and ride away before he walked back into the saloon to sit at one of the tables.
Do you want breakfast, Paco?
Si.
Beans, tortillas?
No, senor. I want steak, eggs, and coffee.
Did Rosita give you some money or something? You are ordering like a rich man.
Paco thought of the saddlebags he had hidden in his room. In them, he had almost $8,000, counting the money he had just stolen from Shula. Rain, like the rattle of musketry and the roll of drums, slashed against the windows of the school building.
Come in.
Dr. Presnell?
Harry White was Sentinel's only pharmacist and was helping tend to those who had been injured in the train wreck.
Yes, Harry.
You said you wanted to know if Mr. Carter's fever broke.
Oh, yes, thank you. So it broke, did it?
About 5 minutes ago. You know what? I think all the rest of them might pull through now.
Doc stood up, then returned White's smile.
I think you may be right. Well, I guess I'll walk around and have a look at them. Some storm we're having.
Yes, it is. A few are disturbed by it, but I think it's just because they're still traumatized by the train wreck.
Yes, I think you're right.
The doctor walked into the ward to look at the first of his many patients. Dr. Galen Presnell was a veteran of the Civil War. He had participated in many campaigns throughout the war, but none worse than Gettysburg, where he treated battlefield wounds that ranged from mere scratches to traumatic amputations. But not since that time had he been involved with such massive numbers of dead and injured. 37 men, women, and children had been killed in the train wreck. 40 more were injured, 12 of whom were seriously injured. The number of dead had overwhelmed the town's only undertaker, so 2 more undertakers had come to help All Britain, one from Stanwix's and one from Mohawk Summit. Those were the next 2 towns west of Sentinel on the Southern Pacific Line, thus making it easy for them to come over. Seth McKenzie, who owned the wagon repair shop, had cleared a place in his warehouse for the bodies to be stored until they could be shipped back home. At the same time, the school building had been turned into a makeshift hospital, there being no hospital in Sentinel, and Dr. Presnell's office not being big enough to handle those who required hospitalization. Dr. Presnell stopped by the bed of each of his patients, spoke for a moment with the ones who were awake, assuring one and all that the worst had passed.
Cannon fire.
I beg your pardon?
Thunder. It sounds like cannon fire.
I take it you have heard cannon fire on the battlefield.
Yes, I was with the 2nd Wisconsin at Gettysburg. Colonel Fairchild's regiment.
I was at Gettysburg as well.
And you know what I mean when I say it sounds like cannon fire.
I do indeed.
Who were you with?
I was with the 10th Georgia, under Colonel John B. Weems, assigned to General James Longstreet's 1st Army Corps.
For a moment, the two men looked at each other. Once committed to a battle that made them deadly enemies, they were now experiencing a moment of reflection that no one else in the room could share or even understand.
Welcome home, brother.
Welcome home, Doc.
By the time Doc finished his rounds, the thunder had moved off and was now a little more than a distant rumble. White was standing by a window looking outside when Doc stepped up alongside him.
Looks like the rain has stopped.
Harry, if you don't mind, I'm going to leave these folks with you for a while. I think I'm going to go over to the Oxbow to have a beer.
You go right ahead, Doctor. Lord knows you've earned it.
The Oxbow was brightly lit with overhead chandeliers and lantern sconces throughout. After he had spent the entire day in the makeshift hospital, the bright and cheery atmosphere of the saloon was a dramatic and very welcome change.
Doc, come on back and join us.
Answering the summons, Doc picked his way through the crowd toward Boomer. As he got closer, he saw that Sally was sitting with him.
How are things going, Doc? Do you really think the worst is over?
I think so, yes. I'm almost positive we won't lose anymore. Actually, I think nearly all of them can go home within another couple of days. We had the last critically injured man die last night. His name was Walter Casey, and he was from Chicago. Can you imagine coming all the way down here from Chicago just to get killed in a train wreck?
Yeah, and not even an ordinary train wreck. It's a train wreck that somebody caused just so they could rob the train.
You have to wonder what kind of man would cause a train wreck and kill all those people just for a few dollars.
Hanging is too good for whoever did it.
Oh, there's Ben.
Sally's face brightened at the sight of Marshal Kyle coming into the saloon.
Ben, join us for a beer?
Don't mind if I do, Doc.
Did you talk to Ms. Dobbs?
Louise Dobbs?
Yes.
How is Mrs. Dobbs doing? I know she broke her arm. Is it giving her much trouble?
She seems to be handling that all right. She's having a hard time over the death of her daughter, though. I didn't plan it, but I got there just as they were having her funeral.
That must have been awkward.
It was at first, but they seemed to think that I'd come out there just for that purpose, and it made me feel very welcome.
Well, Jeremiah and Louise Dobbs are good people.
Poor thing. My heart goes out to her.
So how did you talk with her, Go?
I didn't get too much out of her. Evidently, she believes that Jensen saved not only her life, but the lives of several others who were on the train. So she's not all that disposed toward giving any information that might help find him.
How does she know that it was Jensen who saved her life?
Turned out that she and her son Jerry are the only two who could identify him because they saw him back in Purgatory. Then, when she came into the car to get her out, Mrs. Dobbs recognized him. She said he helped you, Doc.
Helped me?
Yeah. She said he rode in the car with you on the relief train, helping you tend to the injured.
Oh, well, then she was mistaken. That wasn't Jensen.
That wasn't Jensen who rode with you?
Well, no, sir. At least, Jensen isn't the name he gave me. He told me his name was Cavanaugh. Martin Cavanaugh.
Cavanaugh?
Yes.
Kyle pulled a piece of paper from his pocket and studied it for a moment. Then he smiled.
That's him. Cavanaugh is Mac Jensen.
How do you know?
Because I have the name of every passenger that was on the train. There's no Cavanaugh listed. So, since Jensen is the only one we can't account for, and since Cavanaugh is not even listed, it stands to reason that Cavanaugh and Jensen are one and the same.
Well, that sounds reasonable to me. And if you think about it, knowing he had just escaped, there ain't no way a fella like Jensen would give you his real name anyhow.
It would sound reasonable to me as well. Except for one thing.
And what's that?
Isn't this man Jensen supposed to be a convicted murderer?
That's right. He shot and killed a deputy over in Purgatory.
Yes, well, you see, that's the problem. I worked nearly a full day with this man, Cavanaugh. I don't know what he is, but I know what he is not. He is not a murderer. I'm a pretty good judge of character, Ben, and there's no way Kavanaugh would kill somebody in cold blood. Self-defense, maybe, yes, I could see that. But I could not see him killing anyone in cold blood.
What is it with this Jensen fella? He seems to charm everyone he meets. He's got you charmed, he's got Mrs. Dobbs convinced that he saved her life, even though by wrecking the train, he's the one who put her life in danger in the first place.
He didn't wreck the train.
What? You too?
I never met the man, but he was in chains, in the train, being taken to Yuma to hang, right?
Right.
I was talking to some of the railroad workers today. You know, the ones who have been cleaning up the mess out there?
And?
Well, sir, they found that some of the spikes had been pulled out.
Maybe they just worked themselves out over a period of time.
No, sir. They know the spikes were pulled out because they've been tossed to one side. Besides which, they found a pickaxe there, as well as the place where several horses had waited. And from the amount of horse droppings, the horses were probably there for over an hour, which means they had to be waiting for the train. Railroad workers think the train robbers pulled up the spikes, then kicked the track out, just so as to cause the wreck.
It's hard to believe anyone could be that cruel.
Yes, ma'am, it is. But one thing it does do is it pretty much proves that this here Jensen fella couldn't have done it. Not what with him being in chains in the car and all.
Maybe he didn't. Or maybe he had arranged for someone to wreck the train so he could escape.
Ben, seems to me that would be a pretty foolhardy thing to do. He was in the express car. Mr. Kingsley was also in the express car and he got killed.
I don't care how much this Jensen person has charmed all of you. He is still a murderer. At the very least, he murdered Deputy Gillis, because he has already been convicted of that murder back in Purgatory. And the evidence is pretty convincing that he killed Deputy Hayes as well. Maybe it was someone else who wrecked the train.
Did the train robbers actually get anything?
Yeah, they did. The train was carrying a bank transfer of $20,000.
Instead of going after this man Jensen, what about going after whoever actually caused the train wreck? I've got a vested interest in getting them, seeing as how I was on that train and could have been killed myself.
Doc, my job isn't either or, my job is both. So I'll be going after the train robbers and Matt Jensen. Until I see some physical evidence to the contrary, I'm still not convinced they aren't one and the same. Oh, by the way, Doc, is Deputy Hayes' body still here?
Yes, I believe it is. Except for those who lived here, I think all the bodies are still in Seth McKenzie's warehouse.
Good. I want the bullet that killed Hayes. And I want to take Hayes' body back to Purgatory. Oh, and give me a description of Jensen.
I don't know that it is Jensen. Like I said, he told me his name was Kavanaugh.
All right, then give me a description of Kavanaugh.
Mid to late 20s, I guess. He was a lot younger in the face than in the eyes. Those eyes have seen a lot. He's about 6 feet tall, broad shoulders, narrow waist, light blue eyes, and hair that's about halfway between blonde and brown.
Sally, you're a good artist. You've drawn pictures of half the people of this town. Would you draw a picture of Jensen for me? Doc, can you watch her draw it and tell her when she's close?
You don't need to describe him to me.
What do you mean? You mean you aren't going to draw the picture?
No, I mean he doesn't have to describe him to me. He was in here the first night. I bought supper for him. I know what he looks like.
Oh, good. You draw the picture and I'll take it over to Blanton to get a woodcut made.
Marshal.
Yes, Barney, what can I do for you?
The marshal recognized the whiskey drummer.
I heard tell you was looking for whoever robbed the train.
Yes, I am.
Well, I was on the train and I think I seen them.
You think you saw them or did you see them?
I think. That is, I'm sure I did see them.
If you did see them, Barney, would you tell me why in the hell you were just now getting around to telling me about it?
I had to think on it some to be certain in my own mind that that is what I did see.
All right. Tell me about it.
Yes, sir. Well, like I said, I was on the train, but I wasn't hurt none. Anyhow, I got out of the car and was just sort of wandering around when I seen these here four men go into the express car. I thought maybe they was part of the train. Then, no more than a minute later, I seen them come out carrying a canvas bag. I didn't think nothing of it at the time, because to tell the truth, I guess I was still all confused and dizzy and all over having just come through the wreck. But when I heard the train was robbed, it got me to thinking maybe they were the ones who done it.
Can you describe them?
Yes, sir, I think I can. One of them had a scar, a big, ugly purple scar that ran from his forehead through his left eye and down. And the eyelid was all puffed up like it had a big wart on it or something.
Marshal, That sounds just like Cletus Oldham.
Yes, it does. Barney, you said there were others.
Yes, sir, there was three others.
Tell me about them.
One of them was a big man. I'd say 6'4" or so, over 200 pounds. I mean, he was a big, strong-looking son of a bitch. Sorry, Miss Sally.
That's all right, Barney. From what I've heard of Cletus Oldham, anyone who would ride with him would have to be a son of a bitch.
Yes, ma'am, I reckon you're right.
You said there were four.
Four. Well, there was the scar-faced man and the big one, like I said. There was one who was small and dark. I think he was probably a Mexican. The fourth one was a drunk.
Drunk?
No, he wasn't drunk when I saw him.
What do you mean he is a drunk? How can you tell if a man is a drunk if he isn't drunk? And even then, you can be drunk without being a drunk.
Yes, sir, you can, and that's how I know. You forget, Marshal, I'm a whiskey salesman. I reckon I have seen more drunks than just about anyone. Not even bartenders see as many drunks as a whiskey drummer does. But even they can tell someone who's a drunk.
All right. So what do we have here? Cletus Oldham, a big man, small Mexican, and a drunk.
Yes, sir, that pretty much sums it up. I hope that helps you find the ones that done this.
It's a start, thanks.
Well, if it was Cletus Oldham, that's a lead pipe cinch that he's the one who stole the money. Seems to me that lets this fella Jensen off the hook, don't you think?
Well, you might be right. It could be that Jensen just took advantage of the situation to escape. That still leaves us with the fact that Jensen is a convicted murderer. So even if he didn't rob the train, I don't think I would go as far as to say that this would let him off the hook.
What about Oldham? Shouldn't we ought to do something about him?
Yes. If it was Oldham, we should do something about him. But first, we need to find out if it was him. We've got some pretty good pictures of Oldham down at the office. Boomer, how about taking Barney down to the office and showing him some pictures? Don't tell him who they are. Let him pick one out on his own.
I know how to do this, Benjamin. I didn't just start deputying yesterday, you know.
I know you know how to do it, Boomer. I didn't mean anything by it. I was just sort of thinking out loud is all.
That's all right. I ain't put out with you none. Come along, Barney. I got some pretty pictures to show you. Well, now that I think about it, they ain't all that pretty. But I'm gonna show them to you anyway.
Kyle, Sally, and Doc watched Boomer and Barney leave. Then, Doc picked up his mug of beer and took a drink.
I'm glad Barney came along. I knew Kavanaugh, or Jensen, as you say, didn't have anything to do with robbing that train.
Maybe not, Doc. Like I said, he's not off the hook. He is still an escaped murderer.
And I'm telling you, there's no way on God's green earth that the man who pulled all those injured folks from the train and who worked alongside me nursing them could be a murderer.
After getting his horse back, Matt returned to the scene of the wreck, not to watch the cleanup operation, but to get a lead on tracking Cletus Oldham and the others who were responsible. He started on the south side of the track, where he had found the pickaxe, thinking this was probably the side on which the outlaws had waited. It didn't take him long to find the signs of four horses and the direction they took when they left. He knew this had to be them, because the number of horses, four, matched the number of train robbers, four. As he examined the tracks, a sudden smile spread across his face. One of the horses had a tie bar shoe.
Spirit, I don't know which one of these sons of bitches are riding a tie bar shoe. It doesn't matter. He'll lead me to the rest of them.
The little town of Saucedo was American only because it was on the American side of the border. In fact, three-fourths of the people in town were either Mexican nationals or Americans only by an accident of their birth. In layout, the town could have been any village between here and Mexico City, for it was nothing more than a series of adobe buildings built around a center square. In the center square, there was a well, and the well was Matt's first stop. He drew up two buckets of water and added them to the watering trough, which was already more than half full. With Spirit's thirst satisfied, Matt led, rather than rode him, across the square to the Cantina de las Rosas. He tied him off at the hitching rail, then checked the right rear hooves of the other horses that were tied there. He hit pay dirt with the third horse he checked. Matt stepped into the Cantina. There were at least two dozen customers in the cantina, and all were of the same swarthy complexion. Matt stepped up to the bar.
Tequila, por favor.
15 cents.
turned and looked at the crowd. He saw a man who was head and shoulders bigger than anyone else in the room. He had broad shoulders and big hands, and he was eating a steak, not by using a knife and fork, but by holding it in his hands. There were two women with him, one sitting on either side. This was not a handsome man by any means, and the only explanation for his popularity with the women would be that he had a lot of money and was a free spender. Kyle knew that the man fit that bill, because he recognized him as soon as he saw him. This was the one called Bates. Matt ordered a meal of beans and tortillas, then ate slowly, all the while keeping an eye on Bates, though without being obvious about it. When Bates left the saloon, Matt walked over to the window and watched as he mounted the horse with the tie bar. He stayed at the window until Bates rode out of town, then Matt left the saloon, mounted Spirit, and followed. Matt remained so far behind Bates, there was no way the outlaw could see him. Of course, that also meant he couldn't see the outlaw, but that was no problem. Bates was still riding the horse with the tie bar shoe, which meant he might as well have been leaving a painted trail, so easily could it be followed. When Bates made camp for the night, Matt did as well, satisfying himself with a strip of jerky and a couple of chewed coffee beans washed down with a swallow of tepid canteen water. During the night, Matt sneaked into Bates' camp. The fire Bates had built before he went to bed was burned down now, though a few of the coals were still glowing. Bates' hat was over his face as Matt moved quietly toward it. Slipping his knife from his belt, Matt got down onto his knees beside Bates, then brought his knife up to Bates' throat. He hesitated there for just a second. Then he cut the top from Bates' hat. The last thing he did before he sneaked back out of camp was leave a note pinned to the hat.
Bates, I know that you were one of the ones who wrecked and robbed the train. You, Cletus Odom, a Mexican named Paco, and a man named Schuler killed a lot of people that day, including several women and children. I could have cut your throat tonight, the way I cut up your hat. But I'm going to wait until you lead me to the others. And I know you will do that, Bates, because anyone who is cowardly enough to kill children is too much of a coward to face me alone. I figure you have no more than 10 days left to live, and to show you that I mean business, I'm even going to sign my name to this note. Prepare to die, Bates. Matt Jensen.
The next morning, Matt waited on top of a hill looking down on Bates' campsite. Matt wasn't on the actual crest of the hill, but was just below the crest, behind a cut that afforded him concealment. He watched as Bates woke up. The first thing Bates did when he awoke was relieve himself. Then he rolled up his blanket and was tying it to the back of his saddle when he noticed his hat. Matt could tell the very moment Bates saw the hat because he stopped what he was doing and stared at it for a long moment as if he didn't know what he was seeing. Then he saw the note and moved quickly to it, jerking the note off and reading it. Matt could hardly keep from laughing as he saw Bates stiffen, then gingerly reach his hand up to his throat. Bates threw the hat down, then pulled his pistol and looked around. Matt threw a rock and it hit far down the hill from his position. Quickly, Bates saddled his horse, then swinging into the saddle, urged the horse into a gallop. Given Bates' weight and size, Matt knew that the horse would not be able to sustain a gallop for very long. Because of that, he was almost leisurely as he saddled Spirit, then rode at no more than a trot in pursuit. Matt Jensen stopped on a ridge just above the road leading into Chula. He watched an approaching stage as it started down from the pass into the town. Then, corking the canteen, he slapped his legs against the side of his horse and slopped down the long ridge. Although he was actually farther away from town than the coach, he would beat it there because the stage would have to stay on the road, working its way down a series of switchbacks, whereas Matt rode down the side of the hill. Difficult, but a much more direct route. No railroad served Chulik, so the only way to reach it was by horse or by stagecoach. And after a few hours on a bumping, rattling, jerking, and dusty stagecoach, The passenger's first view of Tulip was often a bitter disappointment. Sometimes visitors from the east had to have the town pointed out to them. For from this perspective and at this distance, the settlement looked little more inviting than another group of the brown hummocks and hills common to this country. A small sign just on the edge of town read, Tulip, population 294, a growing community. The weathered board and faded letters of the sign indicated that it had been there for some time, erected when there might actually have been optimism for the town's future. Tulip was like many towns Matt had encountered over the years, towns that bloomed on the prairies and in the deserts, desperately hoping the railroad would come through, staking all on that uncertain future, only to see their futures dashed when the railroad passed them by. Despite the ambitious welcome sign, Matt doubted that there were as many as 200 residents in the town today, and he was positive that it was no longer a growing community. Finding the saloon, Matt saw what he was looking for. Tied to the hitching rail out front were 9 or 10 horses, and one of them he recognized as belonging to Bates. While Matt was dismounting, the stagecoach he had seen earlier came rolling into town. The coach stopped in front of the depot at the far end of the street, and half a dozen people crowded around it. Matt turned his attention back to the task at hand, and checking the pistol in his holster, he went into the saloon. The shadows made the saloon seem cooler inside, but that was illusory. It was nearly as hot inside as out, and without the benefit of a breath of air, it was even more stifling. The customers were sweating in their drinks and wiping their faces with bandanas. Matt looked for Bates, but he didn't see him. The bartender was wearing an apron that might have been white at one time, but was now soiled and stained. Seeing Matt step up to the bar, the bartender moved down toward him.
Whiskey. Looking for a man named Odom. Cletus Odom.
Esther, if you want a whiskey or beer, I'm your man. If you want anything else, I can't help you.
How about a man named Bates? He's a big man. He isn't wearing a hat. Bates' horse is tied up out front.
Is he wanted?
I know Odom is. Bates might be.
You the law?
No.
You a bounty hunter?
No.
Then why are you looking for him?
It's personal.
Mister, maybe you don't know it, but with the clientele I get in here, it ain't a good idea to go around blabbing everything I know. Hell, I could wind up getting myself killed if I was to do something like that.
Matt took out a $10 bill and, though he wasn't obvious about it, he made certain that the bartender saw it.
You say Bates is a big man? We've got a lot of big men who come in here, so that doesn't tell me much. What about the other one you were talking about? What does he look like?
He's uglier than a toad. He has a purple scar on his face and a misshapen eyelid.
Matt did notice a slight reaction to his description.
He is here, isn't he?
The bartender said nothing, but looking around to make certain no one saw the transaction, he took the money, raised his eyes, and looked toward the stairs at the back of the room.
Thanks.
At the back of the saloon, a flight of wooden stairs led up to an enclosed loft. Matt guessed that the two doors at the head of the stairs led to the rooms used by the prostitutes who worked in the saloon. Pulling his pistol, he started up the stairs. Matt tried to open the first door, but it was locked. He knocked on it.
Go away!
What the hell?
The man stood up quickly, and Matt saw that it was the big man Bates. He heard a crash from the next room, and he dashed to the window and looked down. He saw a naked Odom just getting to his feet from the leap to the alley below.
Who the hell are you? Where's your hat, Bates?
It's you!
Bates grabbed his knife from a bedside table.
You son of a bitch! I'm gonna gut you like a hog!
As the big man charged, Matt stepped to one side, grabbed Bates, and pushed him in the same direction that Bates had lunged. Bates slammed headfirst through the window, breaking the glass. A large shard of glass was protruding from his neck. The glass had severed his carotid artery, causing bright red blood to spill from the wound down onto his naked chest.
Where are the others? The others who robbed the train, where are they?
You are going to hell!
Matt hurried back to the broken and now bloodied window. He saw Odom, still naked, riding hard out of town, lashing the animal on both sides of his neck with the ends of the reins, urging him to greater speed. Matt turned and ran from the room down the stairs and out the front, then urged spirit in and galloped in the direction Odom had gone. Matt found the horse Odom had been riding about 5 miles out of town, contentedly cropping grass. He also found the body of a man who had been stripped naked. Odom now had clothes and a different horse. As soon as the track was repaired and service restored, Marshal Kyle took the 9 p.m. train, which was the first eastbound train from Sentinel. Stepping down from the train, Kyle stood on a wooden platform that was adequately, if not brightly, lit by several kerosene lanterns. While the train came to a total stop alongside him, he watched as Hayes' coffin was taken down from the baggage car.
What have we got here?
The station agent came over to look at the coffin.
Who are you?
I'm Colin Randall. I'm the Southern Pacific agent in charge of this depot. Who are you?
I'm U.S. Marshal Ben Kyle. And this is Deputy Hayes.
Kyle pointed to the box.
He's one of yours, I believe.
Hardly one of mine, Marshal. However, he does belong to Marshal Cummins.
Kyle hired a wagon and rode to the Marshal's office. Going inside, he saw someone sitting in a chair behind a desk. The chair was tilted back so that the man's head was resting against the wall. His eyes were closed, his mouth was open.
Excuse me. Excuse me.
Yeah, what do you want?
Are you Marshal Cummins?
No, I'm deputy.
Do you have a name?
Yeah, I have a name. Do you have a name?
I'm United States Marshal Ben Kyle. What is your name, deputy?
The name's Warren. Deputy Ted Warren, Marshal. What can I do for you?
I have Deputy Hayes' body on a wagon out front. I want you to take care of it.
What? What the hell am I supposed to do with that?
I don't care what you do with it. I brought the body back. Now it's your problem. Get it off the wagon.
Well, how am I going to do that? I'm all by myself here.
Like I said, that's your problem.
Well, I've got some men in jail. I'll have them help me.
Fine, you do that. Where can I find the marshal?
More than likely, he's down at the Paradise.
The what?
The Paradise. It's the saloon just down the street. He and all the other deputies hang out there.
All the other deputies? How many deputies are there?
8. Only 6 now, seeing as both Gillis and Hayes has been killed.
6 deputies in a town of less than 300? My God, man, that's one deputy for every 50 people.
Yes, sir. My Marshal Cummins, he likes to keep order.
You get Hayes' body taken care of, I'm going to find the marshal.
Yes, sir.
The Paradise smelled of sour whiskey, stale beer, and strong tobacco. There was a long bar on the left with dirty towels hanging on hooks about every 5 feet along its front. A large mirror was behind the bar, but like everything else about the saloon, it was so dirty that Kyle could scarcely see any images in it, and what he could see was distorted by imperfections in the glass. Kyle couldn't help but make a comparison between this saloon and the Oxbow back in Sentinel. The Paradise did not come out well in the comparison. Out on the floor of the saloon, nearly all the tables were filled. A half dozen or so buffalo gals were flitting about, pushing drinks and promising more than they really intended to deliver. A few card games were in progress, but most of the patrons were just drinking and talking. Looking toward a particularly boisterous table, Kyle saw that all the men were wearing stars on their shirts or vests. There were 6 men and 3 girls at the table, which was the largest table in the saloon. Kyle walked over toward them and dropped the bundle of wanted posters on the table.
Well, what the hell is this?
What does he look like?
Hey, I'll ask the question.
Looking up, he saw Kyle's badge.
Hey, you're a U.S. Marshal.
I am. My name is Kyle. You're Marshal Cummins, I take it.
Yeah?
Cummins looked at the bundle, then smiled.
I'll be damned. How'd you get a picture of him?
Does it look like him?
Yeah, it looks just like him. Duke, get the marshal a chair. Crack. You get some of these posters passed out.
The 2 deputies got up to comply with the marshal's order. Crack took the Dodgers with him, and Duke brought over a chair for the U.S. Marshal. Kyle sat at the table with the others.
Tell me, Marshal, what brings you to Purgatory? You could have just sent these posters.
I brought Deputy Hayes' body back.
You brought his body back? Why the hell'd you do that?
He was your deputy, wasn't he?
Well, yeah.
And I figured this was the place for him. We have enough bodies over in Sentinel now, what with this train wreck.
Yeah, I reckon you would at that. So you say you brought Hayes back. Well, where the hell is he?
He's in your office.
Well, in my office? Damn, why'd you take him there? What the hell am I supposed to do with the son of a bitch?
Well, this is just a guess, mind you, but it's been my experience that it is generally customary to bury bodies.
Well, yeah, sure, but families do that, don't they?
Does Hayes have a family here?
No, fact is, I don't even know where his family is. I think Hayes was from somewhere in Texas.
He was from somewhere in Texas? Well, that's not very helpful. Texas is a big state.
Yeah, I know it is, but that's all he ever told me. He just said he was from somewheres in Texas.
I think he got in trouble with the law back there.
He was in trouble with the law, but you hired him as a lawman.
Hey, he was a good deputy. And when someone comes out here, I believe in giving them a fresh start.
Then it seems to me that the least you can do is give them a decent burial.
Yeah, I reckon I could do that.
Tell me something about Jensen.
Tell you about Jensen?
Yeah, what kind of man is he?
He's a cold-blooded murderer, that's what kind of man he is.
Now that's funny, because from everything I've been able to find out about him, he just doesn't fit the picture of a cold-blooded murderer. What was he like before the murder?
Don't nobody know. He just come into town and shot Deputy Gillis without so much as a fare thee well. Nobody'd ever seen him for that.
You mean the day he arrived is the day he shot Gillis?
No, not the day he arrived, the moment he arrived.
Did he know Gillis from before?
Well, not that I know of.
Did Gillis give him any call to shoot him?
No, all Gillis done was try and collect a tax from him.
What tax? I thought you said he'd just come into town.
Well, that's true, he'd just come into town, but there's a $5 visitor's tax for anyone who comes into town. Excepting you, of course, you being the law and all.
So what you're saying is, Gillis tried to collect the visitor's tax, and Jensen didn't want to pay it, so he shot him down in cold blood.
Yeah, that's what we're saying.
Were there any witnesses?
Yeah, we all saw it.
Yeah, every one of us, plus a bunch of folks that was in the saloon that day. They seen it too.
And you are?
Duke. Name is Duke.
So it happened here in the saloon.
Same as. It was out front.
No, out front is not the same as happening inside. Were any of you out front when it happened?
Yeah, Jackson was out front. He saw it.
Who's Jackson?
I am.
And you saw it?
Well, we all saw it in a manner of speaking. See, we heard the shot. Then we seen Gillis come in here with a big old hole in his chest. Took about 2 or 3 steps. Then he fell down dead right there on the floor. Right after that, Jensen come in behind him, and he was still holding the gun in his hand.
And the gun was still smoking.
What about Gillis's gun?
Ooh, I was hoping you'd ask me about that. See, Gillis's gun was still in its holster. He hadn't even drawn it.
Jackson, tell me exactly what you saw.
Looks like they said. We heard the shot, then we seen Gillis come into the saloon with a bullet hole in his chest.
Now, what do you mean you heard the shot? I thought you said you saw it.
Yeah, I did see it.
You said, and I quote, "Then we seen Gillis come into the saloon." How could you have seen him come into the saloon if you were out front?
I didn't say he was out front, Marshal. I said he saw it. Jackson was standing over there in the window, just looking outside.
Yeah, I was standing over by the window looking outside.
I have to agree that your account does sound pretty damning.
I thought you'd see it our way once you knew the whole story.
Yeah, well, like I said, the picture folks painted of Jensen after the train wreck just didn't fit what happened here. But then, the evidence is pretty strong that he did shoot Hayes after the train wreck.
Oh, I don't doubt that he did that. I mean, we already knew he was a killer, but he was in chains and he didn't have a gun, so truth is, I'm kind of wondering how he did it.
Now, Hayes had a gun, didn't he?
Yeah.
We didn't find a gun with Hayes. So I figure that the train wreck must have knocked Hayes out. And that's when Jensen got the keys, unlocked his shackles, and took the deputy's pistol. And after that, he needed to keep Hayes from coming to and identifying him. So he shot the deputy with his own gun.
Damn. That was a brand new gun, too. I was with him when he bought it off the gun salesman that come through here. Smith & Wesson 44, yes, sir. Hayes set some store in that gun.
Did you say it was a 44?
Yes.
That's funny.
What's funny?
Kyle reached into his shirt pocket and pulled out a bullet. He showed it to the others.
I had the undertaker extract it for me.
So?
This here is a 36 caliber.
You sure that's a 36 caliber? See, sometimes a bullet will get all kind of bent out of shape like when it's been fired. I've seen it a lot of times. I know you have, too.
Does this bullet look out of shape to you?
No, it don't. But that don't mean nothing. Jensen must have had a pistol on him somewhere.
Are you telling me that you arrested him, tried him, found him guilty, and sentenced him, but in all that time you never bothered to search him for a pistol?
Might have been one of them Derringers. They're little and you can hide them real good.
The only Derringers I know are .41 caliber.
Yeah, well, it don't make no difference whether Jensen killed Hayes or not. We know we killed Gillis, and that's what he was being sent to Yuma for.
Well, that's true. No matter what happened with Hayes, it doesn't let Mr. Jensen off the hook. He still stands convicted for killing Deputy Gillis. But it does make my job of finding out what actually happened to Hayes and the money from the train robbery a little more difficult.
Money? What money from the train robbery?
The train was carrying a money shipment of $20,000. That money is gone. Jensen is gone. Well, it stands to reason that he took it.
$20,000? Damn what I couldn't do with that money.
There was a disapproving expression on Kyle's face as he looked at Cummins.
Who? What are you looking at?
What do you mean, what you couldn't do with that money? That's a strange thing for a law enforcement officer to say.
Hell, it ain't like I was thinking on stealing it. I was just commenting on how nice it would be to have that much money, don't you agree?
It ain't something I let myself think about.
Marshal! Marshal Cummings!
The lawman looked around to see Joe Claiborne standing by the bar. He was holding one of the wanted dodgers.
Yeah, Claiborne, what is it?
Claiborne held up one of the wanted flyers that Kyle had brought with him.
Crack gave me this here dodger a couple minutes ago.
Yeah, I told him to hand out some of them.
Yeah, well, the thing is, him giving me this flyer and all makes me think I know who it was that stole your horse.
Stole my horse? What the hell do you mean? When was my horse stole?
Not the horse you ride. I'm talking about the sorrel you was going to sell. You mind that sorrel?
Yeah, of course I remember it.
Well, sir, I'm right sure that I know who stole it. It was this here same fella that you got on the wanted poster here.
Claiborne showed the marshal a woodcut picture on the flyer.
Matt Jensen? Are you telling us that Matt Jensen is the one that stole that horse?
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you.
Oh, you're out of your mind. Jensen's long gone from here.
He ain't that long gone. He was here just a couple of days ago.
Are you talking about before Gillis was killed?
No, sir, I'm talking after that. Fact is, I'm talking about after the train wreck, too. Because what he done was, he brung in a string of horses from Sentinel.
I don't understand. Why would he bring in a string of horses?
He done that because we had to put on extra coaches because of the train wreck.
So, let me wrap my brain around this. What you're telling me is after Matt Jensen escaped, he took a job with a stage line, then came back to the same place where he was convicted for murder. Either you are the dumbest son of a bitch in the world, or he is.
If this here fella in the picture is Matt Jensen, then yes, sir, that's exactly what I'm saying.
All right, suppose it is. Suppose he did bring a string of horses into town. What's that have to do with my horse? What makes you think he's the one that stole it?
Because after he brung them horses in, we started talking about horses and such. I mean, him not having one, you see. Now, see, he rode in here on one of the horses that belongs to the stage line. He said he was looking for a horse, so I told him about the sorrel you had for sale, and he seemed real interested. I figured maybe he would buy it, and maybe if he'd done that, why, you'd give me a little something for steering him to you. Now, of course, after seeing his picture on this poster, I know why he was interested. And, of course, that being his horse you had, why, he wouldn't have no trouble riding it or nothing.
It wasn't his horse. That horse was contraband. I confiscated it legal and all proper-like after the trial.
Excuse me, Marshal, but when you do that, aren't you supposed to hold an auction with all the proceeds to go to the city?
Well, I did hold an auction, and I bought and paid for it with my own money. And that money did go to the city.
When did you see Jensen?
2 days ago.
And when was your horse stolen?
Well, 2 days ago.
Then I'd say that Claiborne is right. Jensen is the one who took it.
Claiborne, if you saw him, why the hell didn't you report him to someone?
Well, how was I to know who he was, Marshal? You never told me his name or nothing, and I hadn't ever seen him.
You didn't see him at the trial?
I didn't know nothing about the trial. But by the time I heard about Gillis getting himself killed and all, why, this here fella had already been tried and was on the train to Yuma to get himself hung.
Are you telling me that the killing and the trial happened on the same day?
Yeah.
And Judge Craig allowed that?
Judge Craig didn't have nothing to do with it. I held the trial my own self.
You held the trial.
In addition to being the city marshal, I am also an associate circuit court judge. It was all legal and proper-like.
It was awfully fast, wasn't it?
Well, we had to do it fast, Marshal. Deputy Gillis was just a real popular man. He was well-liked by everyone. And there were folks around here wanting to string Jensen up that very day. Only way I could keep order was to have a real fast trial.
The only way you could keep order? My God, man, you've got 6 deputies for a town that has a population of less than 300 people. You expect me to believe that you couldn't keep order?
Like I said, Deputy Gillis was a very popular man. And feelings was running real high then. I done what I thought was right.
You did what you thought was right, or you did what you wanted to?
Well, Marshal, wouldn't that be the same thing?
The next morning, as Kyle was eating breakfast at the local cafe, he saw someone approaching his table. The man had unkempt silver hair and clothes that were disheveled, absolute indications that he was down in his luck. Kyle was sure the man was coming to ask him for enough money to buy a drink, and anxious to get rid of him, he reached into his pocket for a nickel. He held the coin out toward the man as he reached the table.
Well, here you go, friend. Have a drink on me.
Thank you, but no. I've been 6 days without a drink, and I hope never to take another.
You don't say. Well then, what can I do for you?
Did the governor send you? Are you here in response to my letter?
No, I don't know anything about a letter.
Oh, you are a U.S. Marshal, aren't you?
Yeah.
I was sure you had come in response to my letter.
And what letter would that be?
You are a U.S. Marshal?
Yes, I'm Marshal Ben Kyle.
Marshal Kyle, my name is Robert Dempster. I'm an attorney.
An attorney? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to sound.
That's all right. There's no need to apologize. I realize that I make less than a sterling impression. I wonder, Marshal, if I might have a few words with you.
At that moment, the waiter brought Kyle's pie and coffee.
Won't you join me, Mr. Dempster? Waiter, bring another piece of pie and a cup of coffee.
There's no need for you to...
Please, join me.
All right. Don't mind if I do.
Another slice of pie and another cup of coffee.
The waiter moved off to fetch the coffee and pie.
Say you're a lawyer.
Yes.
What brought on this present condition? Wait, never mind. It's none of my business. You don't have to answer that.
The waiter delivered the pie and coffee and then withdrew without a word.
Well, it's all right. I can see why one might be curious. Back in Missouri, I was a circuit judge.
Well, that's quite an honorable position.
Yes. Which makes the fact that I dishonored it even more reprehensible.
You took a bribe.
In a manner of speaking, I suppose you could say that. I was trying a murder case when some friends of the defendant informed me that if I did not find some way to free their friend, they would kill my family and me.
And did you find some way to free the defendant?
Yes. I did just as they asked.
Well, if your family was in danger, I don't know as too many people can blame you.
Only it didn't help.
What?
They killed my family anyway.
Oh, damn. Damn, no wonder you have problems.
Problems with no solution. Drinking's no solution.
You said that you haven't had a drink in 6 days. That's a long time between drinks for an alcoholic, ain't it?
Yes, I hope it goes much longer.
What made you stop drinking?
Matt Jensen.
Matt Jensen? Are you talking about the convicted murderer?
Mr. Jensen's no more of a murderer than I am. His trial was a charade and the biggest miscarriage of justice I've yet seen.
Was it a real trial? Did he have a judge, a lawyer, and a jury of his peers?
His defense attorney was an incompetent drunk. The judge was crooked and the jury was fixed.
Now that's quite a charge.
I suppose it is. But I'd gladly make the same charge in an open courtroom, assuming, of course, that the judge hearing the case would be someone other than Andrew Cummins.
Yeah, I can see how you might be hesitant to make such a charge to the very man you are making the charge about. Let me ask you this. What makes you think this man, Jensen, is innocent? I was told by Marshal Cummins that there were eyewitnesses to the shooting who confirmed that he killed Deputy Gillis.
There was only one eyewitness to the shooting, a young boy. And the story he told me exactly coincided with what Jensen said. Gillis drew first, but Jensen was much faster. He drew his own pistol and shot Gillis. Gillis's pistol slipped back down into his holster. But it was not until he went into the saloon that anyone else saw him. That's where he died.
I believe you said you sent a letter to the governor.
I did indeed. I asked the governor to stay the execution until another trial, a fair trial, could be arranged.
As it turns out, your letter was unnecessary. It would seem that Jensen has arranged his own stay of execution. He escaped.
So I've heard. I hope he gets clear out of Arizona. But I'd also hope he could clear his name so this doesn't hang over him for the rest of his life.
Mr. Dempster, if what you tell me is true, then I must say that you have not painted a very good picture of your marshal.
Our marshal is a despot. He rules this town as if it were his own personal fiefdom.
Why does the town council allow such a thing?
He has enough of his deputies placed on the council that he quite easily controls it. They pass any law he dictates and authorize any funding he requests. As a matter of fact, the council no longer even serves the town. They are here for one purpose and one purpose only. They exist for the convenience of Marshal Andrew Cummins.
Do the people of the town support Marshal Cummins?
Support him? No, they don't support him. But most are too frightened to do anything about it. There are a few merchants who've been holding secret meetings, I understand. But whether or not they'll be able to do anything, I don't know.
Have you met with them?
No. I have not earned their trust. But I hope to. Right now, the thing that is keeping me sober is my determination to see Marshal Cummins run out of office and justice done.
That is an honorable goal.